Okay, it's time to start the Quad City Times. And the first article is Biden wins Iowa caucus. President rolls in Democrats' first mail-in caucus, written for us by Caleb McCullough. Des Moines. President Joe Biden easily won the Iowa Democratic mail-in caucus on Tuesday, winning a vote of confidence from the state's Democrats in the first contest since the state was booted from the first spot in the party's nominating calendar. Excuse me. As the last votes were being tabulated at the party headquarters Tuesday morning, Iowa Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart said this year's all-male contest was the result of years of work by the state party. I've been the chair here at the Iowa Democratic Party for a little over a year now, but this process started before I did, she said. And so this is the final culmination of seeing who the Democrats in Iowa are choosing to be their nominee for president. Biden won 91% of the votes, according to unofficial results announced by the party Tuesday night. Marianne Williamson, a self-help author, received 2%, while U.S. Representative Dean Phillips of Minnesota received 3%. 4% cast their vote as uncommitted. With neither long-shot challenger receiving the minimum threshold of 15% of the votes, Biden will be awarded all of the state's 46 delegates to the Democratic National Convention. In total, 12,193 Iowa Democrats returned presidential preference cards in Iowa Democrats' first run at the new process as of Tuesday afternoon. The results from Iowa, one of 16 states and territories to hold the Democratic contest on Super Tuesday, came without the friends and media attention that usually accompanies the Iowa caucuses. And I'm sorry. I seem to have lost my place. I apologize. Instead of voters scrambling into corners in crowded school gyms and complicated caucus math, the vote counting took place in a small room in a nondescript Des Moines office building. The party contracted with a team led by Amber McReynolds, the founding CEO of the National Vote at Home Institute, to oversee the voting and tabulation process. The state party was forced to reinvent its nominating process after the Democratic National Committee removed Iowa from its decade-old position at the front of the presidential primary calendar. After a botched results process in the 2020 Iowa Democratic caucuses, the Democratic National Committee moved to reorder the nominating calendar in an effort to elevate the voices of people of color and encourage primaries over caucuses. The National Party promoted, excuse me, South Carolina to the top spot, awarding the states that give a kickstart to Biden's 2020 campaign. While Iowa Democrats held party organizing caucuses in January, the same day as the Republicans' first-in-the-nation presidential caucuses, the new calendar meant they could not tally votes until after the other early states had voted. Democrats have long had concerns about the accessibility of the Iowa caucuses, which requires voters to go to a caucus site for hours on a winter evening. Critics say the caucuses are inaccessible for people who work nights, have disabilities, or leave the state in the winter. In contrast to those in-person caucuses, Hart said this year's contest is the most accessible in the party's history. All registered Democrats in the state had the option to request a presidential preference card. This is the first time that in Iowa, when you work third shift or when you have small children and you don't have child care in the evenings, you still got to have your vote heard, Hart said. People still participated in this process. The Iowa Democratic Party received 19,609 caucus card requests, and cards postmarked by Tuesday can be counted if they arrive to the party's headquarters by Friday. The party will certify the official results tally on March 16th, Hart said. The number of returned caucus cards so far falls short of the number of people who participated in the party's 2012 caucus, the last time an incumbent Democrat was on the presidential ballot. And it is just a fraction of the more than 200,000 who participated in the competitive 2008 caucuses, which catapulted former President Barack Obama's campaign. Around 110,000 Republicans participated in the party's caucus this year, where there was a competing presidential contest. The caucuses have long served as a tool for party organizing, as candidates have flooded the state with money and media attention during competitive years, driving voter registration and turnout at the caucuses. But without that draw, Iowa Democrats face an organizing challenge, compounding their waning competitiveness in state elections. Hart said the party is examining how it can encourage voters under the new process to turn out for the in-person caucuses and engage them to show up on Election Day. Iowa Democrats have a long ways to go, Hart said. We've talked in the past about how we're reimagining these in-person caucuses now, and I think that that is exactly the way to look at that, she said. It's different. It's a new process. So we've got to figure out how to create more interest around that, how to get better participation at the in-person caucus, just like we're looking at the way to tweak the mail-in process.
One in custody for barn fire. Warrants issued for two others. Rock Island police have arrested one person and are looking for two more in connection with the fire that destroyed the Rock Island livestock auction barn last month. Matthew E. Waddell, 21, was taken into custody early Tuesday, according to a press release from Rock Island police. A detention hearing for Waddell is set for Wednesday, and a preliminary hearing is set for March 19, according to the Rock Island County Court records. Arrest warrants have been issued for William Thomas Cosgard, the 4th, 22, and Caden Joseph Sveck, 18. The warrants are for charges of arson, felony criminal damage to property, and animal torture, the press release said. Rock Island firefighters, backed up by firefighters from multiple area departments, were sent to the auction barn 34th Avenue, for a large fire that resulted in the complete destruction of the facility and the death of one of the cattle on the property. It was determined that the blaze had been set, and the investigation by Rock Island Police and Rock Island Fire Marshal identified the three men. According to Rock Island County Circuit Court documents filed in Waddell's case, the fire caused in excess of $100,000 in damage, according to estimates. Video surveillance from the nearby buildings captured three males at the property about 10 minutes before the fire broke out, the court documents said. The video showed the three males walking near hay bales around the property and huddling behind them. According to the court documents, the three males were seen getting onto a Metrolink bus that was headed toward East Moline. Police from East Moline and Milan were able to identify the three men. Rock Island Police Department Detective Jonathan Shepard interviewed Waddell, who admitted to setting the fire, according to the court documents. Anyone with information on the whereabouts of Cuscard or Svek is asked to contact the Rock Island Police Department at 309-732-2677 or submit a tip through Crime Stoppers at the Quad Cities at 309-762-9500 at p3tips.com. Newsweek.com.
16-year-old girl dies after shooting, written by Gretchen Teske and Anthony Watt. A 16-year-old girl died at a hospital Monday night after suffering from a gunshot wound. Just before 10 p.m. on Monday, March 4, Davenport police, fire, and EMS responded to a home in the 1800 block of Grand Avenue for a report of a gunshot victim. Officers found a 16-year-old girl inside the home with an apparent gunshot wound. She was transported to a local hospital where she later died. The incident does not appear to be a random act of violence and remains under investigation. Davenport Community School District said in an email to the Quad City Times Dispatch Argus on Tuesday that the teen attended Mid-City High School. It did not identify her further. The district said it has called in its crisis response team and additional counseling for Mid-City students and staff. Those resources will be available through the week. District staff are working with law enforcement. School remained in session Tuesday, the district said. Anyone with information is asked to call the Davenport Police Department at 563-326-6125 or submit an anonymous tip to QC Crime Stoppers by visiting crimestoppers.com or downloading the P3 Tips app.
Local union pickets wolf. A local carpenter union has raised concerns about wages paid by a carpentry contractor that's framing what will be a 121-unit apartment building in downtown Davenport. Members of the Mid-American Carpenters Regional Council have occasionally picketed this year in front of a downtown construction site at the corner of 3rd and Main Streets with red and white signs that read, Mid-America Carpenters Regional Council on Strike for Area Standards Against Wolf. The apartment building is planned to be a four-story, 121-unit building in place of a former Wells Fargo Bank drive-through at 128 West 3rd Street. Wolf Construction Services, Incorporated, is a West Des Moines-based commercial subcontractor that specializes in wood framing, trim, and asphalt shingle roofing, according to its website. Wolf did not respond to calls and emails from the Quad City Times Dispatch Argus. Nick Fogel, business representative for Mid-America Carpenters Regional Council, Local 4, a union covering the Quad Cities carpenters, said the union sent Wolf what's called a three-day letter, asking the company to produce documentation that its workers are paid area standards. Area standards is a general term that includes wages, roughly $60 an hour for the area, Fogel said. By them not responding, that allows us to put up this picket, essentially, Fogel said. The letter states, if the company doesn't pay those standards or does not respond, the union will picket the job site. Fogel said the company did not respond to the union's letter. Essentially, they're lowballing us, Fogel said, competing against us and not paying their guys a decent standard of living. The Mid-America Carpenters Regional Council is a regional labor union with a membership of more than 52,000 men and women in Illinois, Missouri, Kansas, and eastern Iowa, according to its website. Fogel said local governments should take into consideration local labor standards when giving tax exemptions to area projects. The Main Street apartment building under construction was approved by Davenport for a full 100% tax exemption over 10 years on an increase in property value. In 2022, the developer sought an Iowa Workforce Housing Tax Credit. Politicians need to do their due diligence when developers are asking for incentives or funding and demand they use local labor and have high labor standards, Fogel said. We live in a consumeristic society. If local labor is not employed on the job site, our economy does not reap the rewards from the tax money we paid to fund this project.
LeClaire council member charged with OWI, written for us by Sarah Watson. LeClaire City Council member Barry Long was arrested early Sunday and charged with operating a vehicle while under the influence, court records show. Long, 55, was booked into the Scott County Jail early Sunday morning on a charge of OWI, first offense, and released on $1,000 cash bail. "I made a mistake," Long said when reached by phone Tuesday. "I own it, and I'm going to deal with it." According to the affidavit filed in Scott County Court, a LeClaire officer saw a white SUV at LeClaire's riverfront levee sitting with its headlights and taillights on and the engine running at about 1:30 a.m. The officer approached the vehicle and the driver, Long, rolled the window down. The officer could smell alcohol and told Long his eyes were bloodshot and watery and he was slurring his words, according to the affidavit. The officer advised Long he wasn't allowed to move the car, according to the affidavit, and told him to call for a ride when he wanted to leave. The officer then left the scene. Shortly after leaving the levee, according to the affidavit, the officer decided he would go back and tell Long and his passenger that he would give them a ride home. As soon as the officer got back to the levee, he wrote what he saw, that he saw the white SUV coming toward him and the levee exit. The officer wrote that he stopped the SUV and again talked to Long, who was in the driver's seat. The officer wrote in the affidavit that he initiated several field sobriety tests and administered a breathalyzer test, which showed Long had a blood alcohol content level of 0.235, according to the affidavit. The legal limit is 0.08. Long was first elected to the LeClaire City Council in 2009, according to Scott County Auditor records, and reelected to his fourth term in 2021. Long made a bid for an open Iowa Senate seat as a Republican in 2022, but lost in the primary to now Senator Scott Webster.
Iowa officials on tour to stop scams. Double check, double check, double check. That was the message Quad City residents heard Monday night from the Iowa Insurance Commissioner Doug Ullman and the Iowa Attorney General Office investigator Al Perales on how to spot red flags and avoid being swindled by what are becoming increasingly complicated scams. "Common scams pull on people's emotion," Perales said. "A scammer might pretend to be a child or a grandchild in distress, a romantic interest, a lottery offer. Those impersonating law enforcement often try to convince the target that their bank account is associated with a criminal activity and they need to protect their assets by withdrawing them and turning over the cash to a stranger or risk being arrested. Remember TIP, tip," said Perales, "because a scammer will want to introduce a threat that they're going to want to bring immediacy, and they're going to ask for payment. Law enforcement agents won't threaten arrest for refusing to give information or payment over the phone, according to the Iowa Attorney General's office, nor will they ask you to keep your conversation secret. According to the Federal Trade Commission, Americans reported losing $8.8 billion to fraud in 2022, up 30% from the previous year. In 2023, Iowans lost $42.6 billion to fraud, with 19,673 reports made, according to the FTC's 2023 annual data book. The median amount lost to fraud was $401. To help educate Iowans and prevent fraud, the Iowa Department of Insurance and Financial Services, the Iowa Attorney General's Office, and the AARP Iowa launched an 18-step tour to educate Iowans about common types of scams in the state and how people can protect themselves. The roadshow stopped in Davenport Monday night at River Center. We know that prevention of fraud is our best defense because once a fraud has occurred, it does not create a lot of challenges for us to bring people to justice. Oman said. So that's why we're here. Perales told several anonymous stories of Iowans who reported fraud to the Iowa Attorney General's office. In one case, a scammer sent a Delmar woman an email telling her she ordered an iPhone. She hadn't, so she called the number listed in the email to cancel the order. She thought she was talking to Amazon. The person on the phone was nice, telling her they would take the care of the problem. Then it changed. They asked whether she was trying to buy a laptop. She said no. They said there might be something wrong with her account and it may be tied to criminal activity. The person transferred her to someone who was supposedly a DEA agent who scared her and told her she was in trouble. They asked how much she had in savings and said in order to protect her assets, they needed her to go to her bank, retrieve $20,000 she had in savings, put it in a box, and ship it to California, where it would be protected by the U.S. Treasury. The next morning, she called and told me the story, and she told me she sent it out of Eldridge, Iowa, at the UPS store, Perales said. He worked with the UPS store to stop the package and got the woman her money back, he said. I wanted to tell you guys this because it wasn't just the Amazon scam, Perales said. Scammers know how to trick you. This scam started out with the voice of a calm, the voice of a helping, a voice of comfort, a voice of trying to fix a problem, and it turned around, and it turned her into a voice that frightened her and worried her. The Iowa Insurance Division also regulates investments in the state, and Oman told the Monday night crowd to take care to learn financial advisors' credentials. All financial professionals that do business in our state have to go through testing and licensing, Oman said. He advised residents to be educated on what they're investing in and be wary of high-yield promises and unregistered investments. He urged Iowans to report any potential investment fraud to the Iowa Insurance Division and any other types of consumer fraud to the Iowa Attorney General's office to be able to investigate suspicious actors and protect them. Scams have increased with ease of access to technology and information scammers can use to manipulate people. That's the increase we're seeing is the ease of technology is giving the ease of technology is giving access to consumers, social media and all that. Just the ability to learn about people, Oman said. Scammers can go in and they can learn a pretty good detail about a lot of people. So when they contact the individual, they're in a really good position to develop a quick relationship. Residents can submit a complaint at Iowa Attorney General's Office website or by calling 515-281-5926, Iowa Insurance Division website, or by calling 515-654-6600.
Barry Others played Wharton in 1972, written for us by Gannon Hannibald. Chuck Berry will be forever synonymous with rock and roll. The St. Louis-born icon helped shape the genre into its form in the late 1950s and 1960s, and in history books the genre is likely to stand on the same podium as Elvis Presley and Buddy Holly. Over those years, he came to the Quad Cities multiple times, playing with local musicians on each visit, just as they did on many of his tour stops. From what we found in the archives, his likely final visit to the Quad Cities came in 1972, when Barry was 45 years old and months away from securing his first number one single, My Ding-a-Ling, which hit the charts in August of that year. The show came on Thursday, May 11, 1972, at Wharton Fieldhouse in Moline. Believe it or not, Barry wasn't even the headliner. On the bill for this weekday show at Wharton was Chuck Berry, Quicksilver, Messenger Service, Spirit, and Trapeze. Quicksilver Messenger Service was a psychedelic jam band from the Bay Area in California, with six albums out by the time they came to town. Their 1969 record, Happy Trails, was certified gold in the U.S. and made Rolling Stone's list of the 500 greatest albums of all time in 2003. Trapeze was an English band still on the rise. The band had just released their third record and their final one with bassist frontman Glenn Hughes. Hughes left the group in 1973 to join heavy rockers Deep Purple. Later in 1985, he replaced Ozzy Osbourne in Black Sabbath for one record, Seventh Star. Spirit was another California rock band whose self-titled debut record, released in 1968, was a hit. It came right after frontman Randy California had finished up playing on tours with Jimi Hendrix, and the album was so successful that the group toured the U.S. that year with an up-and-coming opening band called Led Zeppelin. The band's estate filed a copyright suit against Led Zeppelin in 2014, alleging that the band's iconic hit, Stairway to Heaven, bears too much of a resemblance to Taurus, an instrumental track by Spirit. After Led Zeppelin guitarist Jimmy Page testified before a jury and verdicts were appealed and overturned multiple times, the suit was eventually ruled against Spirit for the last time in 2020. Spirit continued releasing music throughout the 70s and 80s until California-born Randy Wolf died from drowning in 1997. The stacked show at Wharton Fieldhouse sold for between $4.50 and $5.50, that's dollars and cents, and started at 7 p.m. All advertisement ahead of the show promised 6 hours of music, a marathon affair that would have run well into Friday morning. It wasn't even the only major event at that time of the year in Quad Cities. 2 days after Barry and Company played at Wharton, comedian George Carlin had a show booked at the Masonic Temple. Later that month, Johnny Cash came to Davenport for one of his many visits, too. 5 months later, in October, the Masonic Temple hosted the Carpenters and Hank Williams, Jr., for two separate shows in the same week. The gig marks Moline's first entry into the Timeless Ticket series, though the opening of the mark in 1994 made the city the home of big gigs starting in the 90s. On the front page of the Times-Democrat on May 11, 1972, is a story about a Supreme Court ruling impacting Iowa high school athletes. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the ISAA's law banning athletes from playing after occupying a car, knowing that alcoholic beverages are in the vehicle, was invalid. The number one movie at the office was The Godfather for the eighth straight week, where it stayed through the end of August. And this is part of a story series called Timeless Tickets, where we're aiming to find the most notable concert in the Quad Cities every year from 1960 to today. If you have a story or photo to share from an iconic local show, send it to entertainment reporter Gannon Hannibold at gannibold@qctimes.com. It's time for the obituaries. So, Pamela?
Funerals that are coming up. Don Scott, 59, of Bluegrass, Iowa, passed away Monday, March 4th, at her residence. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial, Moline. Waldo Clyde McCarty, 88, of Carbon Cliff, Illinois, died Monday, March 4th, in Carbon Cliff. Arrangements, Van Ho Funeral Home, East Moline. Mary E. Her name is spelled E-A-R-P, ERP. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. 88, of Bettendorf, died Monday, March 4th at Genesis Medical Center in East Campus in Davenport. Arrangements are pending at McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home in Bettendorf. Robert L. Daly, 70, of Davenport, Florida, passed away Thursday, February 29th. Survivors include his brother, Michael Daly of Moline. Local arrangements by Trimble Funeral Home and Crematory in Moline. Tracy Matthews, 54, of Davenport, passed away Tuesday, March 5th, at Clarissa C. Cook Hospice House. Arrangements are pending at Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home. Jean Gordon Hansen, 96, of Moline, died Monday, March 4th, in her home. Funeral arrangements are pending at Trimble Funeral Home and Crematory in Moline. William Bill Nelson, 92, of Silvis, Illinois, passed away Monday, March 4th, at Clarissa C. Cook Hospice House, Bettendorf. Arrangements are pending at the Van Hoe Funeral Home, East Moline.
Franklin Ed Nett, December 2, 1944 to February 23rd. Franklin Ed Nett, 79, passed away on February 25th at Genesis East Medical Center. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, March 19th at Grace Evangelical Free Church in Davenport. Visitation will begin at 10 a.m. and conclude at the time of service. Ed will be laid to rest alongside his beloved wife at Rock Island National Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be made to Habitat for Humanity Restore. Online, condolences and fond memories may be expressed at www.veertsfuneralhome, that's WEERTSFH.com. On December 2nd, 1944, in Davenport, Ed was born to parents Anna Bance and Donald Nett. Following high school, he went on to obtain his associate's degree. Ed worked as a mechanical designer until he retired in 1999. On September 7, 1968, Ed married the love of his life, Jill Sloan. Together, they had nearly 50 years in each other's company before Jill passed in 2017. Ed loved all things wood, old, and repurposed. Using wood often found at the Restore, he could make anything in his workshop. It was not just the thing that he made which was special. It was the love and time he put into the piece that his loved ones cherished most. Family and faith was of utmost importance to Ed. He was a member of Grace Evangelical Free Church, where some of his woodworking pieces can be found to this day. Ed would set up for women's Bible study every week. Even after Jill's passing, his love was a constant and will always be a constant. Survivors include his children, Penny, spouse Brian Bonifant, John, spouse Ivana Nett, sister Pat, spouse Lynn Snyder, grandchildren, and an honorary family member, Ellen Burris. Ed was preceded in death by his wife, Jill, and his parents. And from Eldridge, Craig Allen Ohl, O-H-L. June 11, 1970 to March 3rd. Craig Allen Ohl, age 53, of Eldridge, passed away unexpectedly on March 3rd at his home. A memorial service will be held at 6 p.m. Friday, March 8th, at Halligan McKay DeVries Funeral Home in Davenport. The family will greet friends from 4:30 p.m. until the time of the service. Memorials may be made to the family to be used for the Ohl Family North Scott Wrestling Scholarship. Greg was born on June 11, 1970, to Stephen and Lynn from North High School. To Stephen and Linda Lenser Ohl. He graduated from North Scott High School in 1989, where he wrestled and placed sixth at the Iowa State meet. Craig graduated from Luther College in 1993, where he majored in business, wrestled, and played golf. He worked at Granger in Davenport for 20-plus years. Even though Craig lived with physical challenges and adversity, he never complained and used it to draw strength. Craig was a wrestling fan of the Lancers and Hawkeyes. He enjoyed fishing, hunting ducks from his camouflage chair, and golf. He always caught the largest fish when out with others. He even skipped a final exam at Luther to land a big trout he saw earlier in the stream. Craig had a big heart and was a great brother, son, uncle, nephew, and friend. He is survived by his father, Stephen, wife, Sonia Ohl, sister-in-law, Peggy, Tom Ohl, and Charlie Ohl, Aunt Carol, Uncle Rick, and several cousins and friends. Craig was preceded in death by his brother, Brent Ohl, his mother, Linda Ohl, grandparents, Twyla and Jack Ohl, Violet and Ralph Lenser, and aunt and uncle Jordan and Jackie Hull, and his very favorite cat, General Patton. Online condolences may be made to the family by visiting his obituary at hmdfuneralhome.com.
Turning now to the opinion section of the Quad City Times, this is an article by Robert Reich, Escaping Trump's Revenge. Excuse me. Nikki Haley won the Republican primary in Washington, D.C. recently with about 63% of the vote to Donald Trump's 33%, securing all 19 available delegates and becoming the first woman to ever win a Republican presidential primary. To be sure, the contest was tiny. Just over 2,000 Republicans voted in the overwhelmingly Democratic city of Washington. But I admire Nikki Haley's tenacity. On the other hand, I'm learning something disturbing about the other Trump opponents, both Democrats and Republicans. When I served in Bill Clinton's cabinet, one of my favorite progressive lawmakers was Jim McDermott, who represented Seattle from 1989 to 2017. Jim had a long and distinguished legislative record. In his final year in Congress, he became one of the most trenchant critics of Donald Trump. He's still criticizing Trump from his safe house. Soon after Trump was elected in 2016, Jim blasted him for issuing inflammatory tweets, such as claiming without evidence that millions of people had voted illegally in the presidential election. Jim also openly worried about the future sessions of Congress. I think it's going to be very tough helping the new president understand how a democracy actually works. Jim is now living in a Sivrac in, the French town, Sivrac-en-Médoc, a town of a few hundred people in western France, north of Bordeaux. In a recent interview with Elizabeth Becker, a former Washington Poet Post correspondent, Jim said he's getting calls from former colleagues in Congress who fear what a vengeful Trump might do if reelected. They wonder how to gauge the seriousness of Trump's increasingly dire threats to American democracy and potentially to them and their families. They are scared to do what I did, to expatriate from the U.S. But they are scared to stay, Jim said. He tells them, if you can afford it, buy a second home somewhere in France or Spain or Portugal, wherever, a second house that could become a safe house. I've heard similar concerns in recent months from lawmakers, officials, prosecutors, journalists, and celebrities who have been publicly critical of Trump. They worry about Trump's promise of retribution if reelected, his intention to direct the Justice Department to investigate every Marxist prosecutor in America, his claim that his indictments have released the genie out of the box that would allow him to weaponize government against his opponents and vow to root out the radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country. They're also concerned about the apparent willingness of Trump's followers to resort to violence against his opponents. A third of Republicans agree with the statement that true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save our country. Among Republicans with a favorable view of Trump, 41% now agree that violence may be necessary. By contrast, 22% of independents and 13% of Democrats agree. It only takes one crackpot, like the guy who tried to kill Paul Pelosi, one former lawmaker told me. I never thought this nation would get to the point where critics and opponents of a potential United States president begin to wonder whether to leave the country and to keep themselves and their families safe. That's the standard for critics of bloodthirsty dictators like Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un. But in America? Elizabeth Becker asks rhetorically, is the United States facing a situation so dangerous that you would be foolish if you didn't have a backup plan? Is it hyperbole to imagine the country sliding into authoritarian rule that would unleash violence, retribution, and repression? I hope not, but the mere fact the question is being posed is itself a frightening commentary on where we've come and may be heading. Every American, including Jim McDermott, has a right to live where they feel safe, of course, and if they can afford a backup plan, they may be wise to consider one. But I hope people with Jim's principles and abilities and Nikki Haley's tenacity remain here to defend America against Trump's threats to democracy, even if he's defeated in November. And Robert Reich is a former U.S. Secretary of Labor. He's a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. His columns are syndicated by Tribune Content.
Some letters to the editor. Republicans misrepresenting border crisis. Millions of humans are leaving their countries due to violence, war, hunger, and climate change. This recent surge of global human migration has fueled populist, isolationist, authoritarian movement all over the world, including the MAGA movement in our Republican Party. Let's look honestly at immigration into our country. Due to our low birth weight, the United States must accept 1 to 2 million immigrants annually to sustain our economy. The Bipartisan Policy Center claims the immigration surge helped our economy recover quickly from the pandemic, filling staffing shortages and repairing supply chain disruptions. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that expanding the U.S. labor force by 5.2 million people over the next decade, mostly from immigration, will improve the U.S. GDP by $7 trillion and increase revenues by $1 trillion. Current U.S. asylum immigration processes are being gamed because federal and state governments have not committed sufficient resources to support the surge of immigrant asylum seekers into this country. Detaining millions of desperate immigrants is impossible and cruel. Most immigration asylum seekers are taken into U.S. custody, then released pending court dates to review their claims. The Biden administration asked Congress for more immigration resources. The Senate passed a bipartisan bill increasing immigration funding by $20.23 billion. House Republicans refused to consider the Senate bill because Trump wants to blame President Biden for the border crisis. Republicans are spreading lies and propaganda to demonize immigrants, misrepresent the border crisis, and downplay the benefits that immigrants bring to America. Democrats support immigration policies that are honest and humane. Please support Democrats. Written for us by Richard Patterson of Moline. And fraud is intended criminal deception. I found it interesting that retired Judge Donald O'Shea made the case on today's, February 29th, editorial page that prosecution for fraud is not warranted if the fraud is not discovered until after defrauded parties have been reimbursed. Dictionary definitions from Oxford Languages. And they show here fraud and then phonetic spelling. A noun, wrongful or criminal deception intended to result in financial or personal gain. He was convicted of fraud. Written for us by Mark Bernhardt of Moline. And join Quad Cities Coalition for Palestine event. Quad Cities Coalition for Palestine was founded with the goal of educating the public regarding the history of the Palestinian struggle for liberation and the ongoing genocide of the Palestinian people. We are a group with a diverse background of peace activists from all areas of the Quad Cities and multiple different ideologies and faiths. Since October 7, 1,200 Israeli and over 30,000 Palestinian lives have been lost, and many more have been taken hostage. Each day that passes without a ceasefire brings more violence and suffering. We ask you to join us in taking a stand for peace. Saturday, March 9 at 1 p.m., we will be meeting at the LeClaire Park and Bandshell. That's at 400 Beiderbecke Drive in Davenport. We plan to rally, march, and enjoy sponsored food provided by a generous local vendor as we raise awareness of the desperate need for an immediate and permanent ceasefire. By supporting a ceasefire, we confirm our commitment to compassion and empathy, recognizing the shared responsibility to protect the most vulnerable members of humankind. Through dialogue and a commitment to peaceful resolution, we can pave the way for a future free from the specter of violence, ensuring that the children of Palestine can grow up in an environment where their innocence is preserved. Let us unite in our pursuit of a ceasefire resolution, standing as a beacon of hope for the countless innocent lives caught in the crossfire. Written for us by James Cox of Moline.
Before November 5th, do your homework. Be independent. This article is written for us by Steve Corbin, who is a professor emeritus of marketing at the University of Northern Iowa. Conventional wisdom, witnessed by talking to your next-door neighbors, friends, and even strangers, reveals contemporary American politics is deeply polarized. Rachel Kleinfield of Carnegie Endowment for the International Peace notes some scholars claim that Americans are so polarized that they are on the brink of civil war. The January 6 U.S. Capitol insurrection and ensuing lawsuits prove that a political, civil war already exists. The headline of an op-ed in the Washington Post, authored by Francis Wilkinson, a U.S. politics and policy expert, sounds the clarion bell. The only U.S. civil war will be a war on democracy, September 3, 2023. These alarms are nothing new. Research by the American Political Science Association notes divisiveness started in the U.S. Senate in the mid-1950s and in the House of Representatives around the mid-1970s. The most likely DNR presidential candidates are not liked by 60-70% of the voters. Both presumptive candidates are referencing the November 5th election as a democracy versus authoritarian dictatorship decision point. As of January, a Gallup poll noted 43% of voters consider themselves independent, and the Republicans and Democrats equally divide the remaining population. Odds are the GOP lemmings will vote, regardless of research and legal findings, for Trump, and the Democratic Party conformist will vote for Biden. The independents who do their research will determine who will lead America for the next 4 years. Odds are also great that political parties will most likely tell their card-carrying members and foes from the other side a combination of disinformation, misinformation, and propaganda, hoodwinking in orientation, and a smattering of truth. Much of the time during the political races, we're bombarded with massive and even conflicting information. No matter how hard we try, it's difficult, if not impossible, to decipher the truth from fiction. It's during turbulent times like these where free-thinking citizens seek vote guidance and defer to expert opinion. Social science experts in political science who belong to the APSA, along with politically oriented research scholars, participated in the November 15 to December 31, 2023 survey. A cursory review of the research titled the 2024 Presidential Greatness Project Expert Survey was published in the New Los Angeles Times on February 18. Here are the paramount research findings from specialists who study American presidents for a living that should give voters some compelling guidance. 1. Joe Biden was ranked as America's 14th greatest president. Donald Trump came in last at number 45. U.S. has had 46 presidents, with Grover Cleveland serving as the 22nd and 24th president. Researchers count him just once. 2. Experts in presidential politics who identified themselves as conservative-oriented and Republican ranked Biden considerably higher than Trump for presidential effectiveness. 3. Mr. Trump was identified by far as the most polarizing president, 7 spots higher than Mr. Biden. 4. Biden was acknowledged as the 6th most underrated president, while Trump came in as the 8th most overrated president. Research conducted in 2022 by the Siena College Research Institute, revered for their unbiased research and valid findings, corroborates the APSA's findings. The Institute ranked Biden as the 19th best president and Trump as, again, number 45. As the LA Times noted, should a Biden-Trump rematch occur, voters will be in that unique position of knowing how both candidates performed while they were in office to protect and defend America. Between now and November 5th, be independent, like nearly half of the voters, and do your homework with this op-ed presents as an example. Choose the candidate who you are convinced will demonstrate accepted norms of presidential leadership, keep America as the leader of the free world, and preserve our constitutional rights, promote bipartisanship, respect laws of the land and the judicial system, keep our global trade alliances, support our military, stand up against CRINK, in other words, China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, and maintain America as a democracy versus falling into dictatorial authoritarian control. What would you be most proud of telling your family 10 to 15 to 20 years from now? That you blindly followed the order of political party preference in the 2024 presidential election without thinking twice, didn't vote, or was a free-thinking voter who seriously researched the candidates and determined America's future?
There's an article here about Clark, and that would be Caitlin. Don't have time to read the whole thing, so I'm just going to read the box that's right at the side. Iowa, OSU TV ratings, highest in 25 years. Caitlin Clark's record-setting game for Iowa against Ohio State on Sunday attracted more than 4 million television viewers at its peak and was the most watched women's regular season basketball game since 1999, Fox Sports announced Tuesday. Clark scored 35 points and passed Pete Maravich as the NCAA Division I overall career scoring leader during the Hawkeyes' 93-83 win. Average viewership was 3.39 million and reached a high of 4.42 million late in the second half. Clark set the record with 2 free throws just before halftime. No women's regular season game on any network had more viewers since 3.88 million tuned in for UConn, Tennessee in January 1999, according to Sports Media Watch. The game was the second most watched college basketball game of the season, trailing only the 5.18 million who saw the Michigan State-Arizona men's game that followed an NFL Thanksgiving game on Fox, SMW said. Ohio State-Iowa surpassed the 3.01 million who watched the Boston Celtics' 140-88 rout of the Golden State Warriors on ABC on Sunday. Resilient Knights rally. There's a big photograph of two fellas fighting over a basketball. Assumption junior Braylon Thompson is fouled by Ballard's Parker Miller during Tuesday's state quarterfinal game at Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines. The Assumption moved to the semifinals with an 84-73 victory. Assumption survives foes' early onslaught to reach semifinals. This is a staff report. Des Moines, you would think that 13 made three-pointers, shooting nearly 50% from behind the arc and having a 14-0 first quarter run on your side would be enough to win a basketball game. And you know what? We are out of time, so I'm going to do the close, going to close this. Because it is the end of our Quad City Times for today. I'm Patty Daniels, and my partner at the microphone has been Pam Rhodes. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.